In the bluegrass region of Kentucky, the thoroughbred foaling season is underway, meaning sleepless nights for the farm managers and stable hands as they help new baby horses into the world. NPR's Noah Adams went there to experience one of those births and pay a visit to an equine neonatal intensive care unit where newborn foals are treated.
I noticed when I first met Eduardo Terrazas at his foaling barn, I noticed his eyes, smiling and very tired. When the babies are coming, it's hard to find any time to sleep.
For two nights in a row, I think I only slept 1 hour one day and about 2 hours the next day. Normally, I'm here with the guys at night. They call me, and I come here because I do like to be here on every birth. I deliver every foal.
Every foal this season will mean 51 for Eduardo Terrazas, who came to Kentucky from Mexico years ago, worked as a stallion manager before starting his own boarding farm. It's called Terrazas Thoroughbreds, south of Lexington. They take care of 60 mares year-round and 120 others which are shipped in to have their foals or be bred, or both.
I have mares from New York, California, Canada, three from Argentina, Florida, New Jersey.
His foaling barn has a wide center aisle. Doors stand open at both ends. The stalls are concrete block, painted white, clean straw. In late afternoon, Eduardo checks the mares who are close to their due date. Is there a certain look in the eyes? Does the rump look like it's dropping? Is the udder gathering milk, getting waxy? The most likely mother doesn't really seem ready.
You can see her bag is fuller. However, the milk hasn't come down to the nipples yet. At this point, I don't really think we're going to have one tonight.
Eduardo, who lives 10 minutes away, leaves to pick up his kids from school, and it's home for dinner and maybe some sleep on the couch, his cell phone on his chest to vibrate if his night watchman calls.
Ashley Edge, please call 391.
Lexington has two world-class equine hospitals. And that's because of the money that's involved in thoroughbred breeding and racing. Horses sell at auction for millions. Stud fees can easily go over $100,000.
We are standing in the intensive care unit at Rudin Riddle Equine Hospital. It's primarily for the neonatal foals, so newborn foals that are sick.
Dr. Bonnie Barr leads an intensive care team at Rudin Riddle. These are also people who don't go out of town or get much sleep during the foaling season. The hospital's NICU has 8 stalls. On this afternoon, 7 are full.
Last night we had a foal that came in that was just born on the farm, and it wasn't breathing on the farm. The farm veterinarian did CPR. They brought the foal in here immediately. It was breathing by the time it got here. My concern with the fact that he had a lack of oxygen right at birth is that it can affect his brain. There he is.
The colt is quiet in a front corner of the stall, supported on a foam pad with blankets, eyes covered, cotton in his ears.
So right now he's kind of in a drug-induced coma because when he came in, he was very hyper-responsive, not acting like a newborn foal. Mm-hmm. And then the excitement that happened when you just walked in here is his mother was showing me some signs. She was just kind of quivering that maybe she's having a problem post-foaling. It was a good-sized foal, and they can have complications after foaling.
Most of the stalls have both the mother and the baby. There is one orphan foal whose mother died soon after giving birth. They'll bring in a nurse mare. Another newborn was not tolerating her mother's milk.
We've got her on some intravenous fluids, and then the kind of milky white bag is total parental nutrition. It's made up of dextrose, lipids, and protein.
She looks good right now.
She does, yes. Earlier she was rolling around in the stall saying, "My belly hurts." Not saying it, but showing me that her belly hurts, and everybody else in here.
Veterinarian Bonnie Barr, watching over babies and mares at Rudin Riddle. The hospital also has 24 ambulatory vets with their trucks full of equipment ready for calls from out on the farms. And that's usually at nighttime during the foaling season. It is nighttime when Eduardo Terrazas walks in out of the cold and dark to find the mare he's been watching. She's almost ready, but having trouble. She's lying down. Breathing is heavy.
She's got a thickened placenta here, so she's not going to be able to break her bag. So I'm going to break it for her. So we need something sharp to puncture it. I'm breaking it now.
And first to appear, the front hoofs and the forelegs stretched out. Between the legs, you can see the nostrils, then an eye, and it's open.
Hold on, I might help you. You see he's a little sideways. And what we do, we just kind of tug. We don't push or pull unless we have to. Once you pass the shoulders, sometimes they get hung from the hip. But this mare isn't all broke.
And with a gush, the foal is clear out on the straw. Eduardo cleans the nostrils and the mouth.
Is it a boy?
Eduardo's family has come to watch the birth. 10-year-old Michael wants to know if it's a boy. His sister tells him Dad hasn't had a chance to look yet. The umbilical cord is tied. Eduardo gives the foal an enema solution. A small oxygen tank is hooked up.
Not everybody does this, but I give all my babies the first 4 or 5 minutes with oxygen in case they lost oxygen during the delivery.
And soon the baby horse is standing, trying to figure out what legs are for. The legs are tall. You look from one animal to another and wonder how the little one was ever up inside the big one. The mother gets a shot, a painkiller, lots of praise as she licks her baby, which is indeed a boy. It's a colt.
So the owner, as soon as the baby's born, they get a picture of their baby.
Cell phone pictures are sent off to the owners in Georgia. This little thoroughbred is an investment. The owners had paid a stud fee of $25,000. The colt will most likely bring $100,000 at the yearling auction. Eduardo Terrazas celebrates the birth by brewing a pot of coffee. He says barn coffee is always the best. And then he turns to the next door stall and a mare that may just be waiting for things to quiet down. In the bluegrass state this foaling season, late January into June, 8,000 registered thoroughbred colts and fillies will be born. And one of them just might win the Kentucky Derby as a 3-year-old. Noah Adams, NPR News.
Russia holds a presidential election this Sunday. Despite massive anti-government protests recently, Prime Minister Vladimir Putin is widely expected to win. If he does, he'll return to an office he held from 2000 to 2008, and he'll continue his run as Russia's most powerful politician. Putin is the subject of a new book called The Strongman, Vladimir Putin and the Struggle for Russia. The author is Angus Roxburgh, a journalist who once served as a public relations advisor to the Putin-run Kremlin. Roxburgh said Putin's time in the KGB really shaped his worldview.
I very much have the feeling that he retains from that period a great suspicion of the West, even today when there are democratic demonstrations going on in Russia, protests at the fraudulent elections that we've seen recently. He sees that as part of a Western plot to harm Russia, to bring him down.
You know, you mentioned the protests in Moscow, and some thought that when Putin was accusing the West of kind of being behind them, that was for domestic politics. You're suggesting that he genuinely believes that there's some sort of Western interference causing these protests against him.
I really think he believes it very much. He sees it as a continuation of the so-called Rose Revolution in Georgia and the Orange Revolution in 2004.
These former Soviet states, yeah.
Former Soviet states, which decided to choose pro-Western leaders in 2003-2004. He believed very firmly that the West was behind those protest movements, that this was a Western plot which in the end would come to Russia.
I want to take us back to 2001. Vladimir Putin is new to the Russian presidency. George W. Bush is new to the American presidency. And the two men meet and President Bush said something that is now very famous.
I looked the man in the eye. I found it to be very straightforward and trustworthy. We had a very good dialogue. I was able to get a sense of his soul.
You wrote in the book that this was very Putin, that he was able to sort of manipulate his own persona if he wanted to make someone, a counterpart like President Bush, feel comfortable. This is very much a part of his strategy.
I think it's part of his KGB training as well. He once told a friend, when asked what his job in the KGB was, he put it very vaguely. He said, "My job is to mingle with people." And part of that, I think, is his ability to make people feel very comfortable. With President Bush, I think he exercised that sort of almost control over him. He made George W. Bush believe that Putin was a man he could trust and could do business with.
Manipulation aside, that moment did also seem to be sort of a moment of opportunity for the United States and other Western governments to work with a new Russian leader. And Putin seemed to be giving at least the impression that he believed in democracy, that he believed in economic ties with Europe. I mean, it seemed a real moment of hope for the West coming together with Russia.
Yeah, I think that's right. Nowadays, it's very easy to paint Putin in black and white terms, but actually he's a more complex character. When he first came to power, in those first years, he said quite openly to Western leaders that he wanted to bring Russia back in from the cold. He even spoke about joining NATO. And for him, it was a symbol that Russia could become part of the West again. And I think that he felt constantly rebuffed by the West. He faced an American president in George Bush who was determined to build a missile shield to protect the West from nuclear missiles, which Russia, rightly or wrongly, believed was aimed against them. He also saw the West expanding NATO right up to Russia's borders. From our point of view, there was no malicious intent in that. But from his point of view, it looked as if Russia was being sort of encircled by a military alliance.
Well, let's talk about that feeling of being threatened that Russia had. I mean, did Western powers, did the United States ever understand that, ever see the Russian side of things?
I think there were different opinions in the American administration. You had people like Condi Rice, who is a Russia specialist. She speaks Russian. She's tough on Russia, but she did try to understand where Russia was coming from. And I think that made her stand out from, if you like, the neocons in the Bush administration. And they were the ones who set the tone, really, for America's policy towards Russia. I think the main thing for them was to cement, as they put it, the gains of the end of the Cold War. They believed that the countries of Eastern and Central Europe had gained their freedom. And the one thing that American policy must do in the face of a Putin regime which was cracking down on human rights was to make sure that they would never lose that freedom again.
Let's come to today. If Putin does indeed win this upcoming presidential election in Russia and takes over, returns to the Kremlin, how will things change? What do you expect?
Well, things have changed a lot in the last few months. In December, when there were parliamentary elections, which were clearly fraudulent, there's so much video on YouTube, for instance, you can literally watch ballots being stuffed into boxes and so on. And this has given rise to a protest movement in Russia, which everybody says has really changed things. And even if Putin wins in the first round, as he may well do this Sunday, he has got to take account of this movement somehow. He knows now that his support has been eroded and that he faces a lot of opposition, in particular from the entrepreneurs, the business people that he needs to rely on to build a new Russia. So one way or another, he's got to take account of that.
You know, there was a paragraph towards the end of your book that really struck me, and I want to read it. You said, "The picture of Russia that has emerged from these pages is not the one I would have wished to paint or that I imagined painting 20 years ago." What picture did you imagine painting?
Well, 20 years ago, the Soviet Union collapsed. All the East European countries gained freedom, became democratic. Everybody, I think, hoped that Russia would go the same way. And for a lot of reasons, partly domestic reasons, but also, as I point out in the book, because I think the West mishandled the changes in Russia, it didn't happen. I think the introduction of capitalism, the free market, during the 1990s under Boris Yeltsin was far too quick, far too chaotic, and it meant that a lot of Russian people actually lost faith in the very words democracy and capitalism because it became associated in their minds with nothing but utter chaos and poverty for millions of Russians. Then Putin came along, vowing to put that right, to put an end to the chaos, and in some ways he has done that. But of course, instead of extending democracy, he's cracked down on media freedoms and made things much tighter in Russia. So under both Boris Yeltsin and under Putin, for very different reasons, things have gone pretty badly wrong in Russia. And that's why I feel that it is a shame that the hopes that we all had 20 years ago that Russia would somehow emerge as a real democratic friend of the West haven't materialized.
Angus Roxborough, thanks so much for talking to us.
Thank you.
That's the voice of Angus Roxborough. His new book, The Strong Man, is out today. This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm David Greene.
And I'm Renee Montagne. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. Good morning. I'm Renee Montagne.
And I'm David Greene. Let's go to Britain now, where a second newspaper owned by Rupert Murdoch's News Corporation is now the focus of scandal. As NPR's David Folkenflik reports, police investigators say at the Sun tabloid, there was a culture of illegal payments aimed at creating a network of informants within the government.
Over the past week, Rupert Murdoch has been in fine form in London as he personally helped to oversee the launch of his leading daily tabloid to a seventh edition with a brand new Sun on Sunday. Murdoch told staffers, quote, "For 43 years, the Sun has been a tremendous force for good." It was a jaunty note to strike. 10 current and former Sun journalists have been arrested on suspicion of bribery. And yesterday, Deputy Assistant Police Commissioner Sue Akers offered her testimony at a formal inquiry into the newspaper scandals.
The payments have been made not only to police officers, but to a wide range of public officials. So there are categories as well as police, military, health, government, prison and others. This suggests that payments were being made to public officials who were in all areas of public life.
Akers had a pointed characterization of what that had created.
The current assessment is that it reveals a network of corrupted officials.
And that has implications for the Sun newsroom as well.
There also appears to have been a culture at the Sun of illegal payments, and systems have been created to facilitate those payments, whilst hiding the identity of the officials receiving the money.
In the UK, journalists can cite the public interest to ward off prosecution for illegal acts they have committed to acquire information. But Akers said the vast majority of the stories instead involved salacious gossip and the invasion of privacy. News Corp closed the Sun's sister Sunday paper, News of the World, last summer at the height of the cell phone voicemail hacking scandal. This new round of arrests at the Sun represents a second wave of the scandal focused on bribery. Sun Associate Editor Trevor Kavanagh earlier told the BBC the inquiry was a witch hunt by police who are themselves under scrutiny.
On the basis of the evidence that's being suggested to those who have been arrested so far, it's pretty flimsy stuff.
Some British journalists are suggesting the arrests stem from little more than buying a round of beer for the cop on the beat. Akers specifically rules out such minor fraternizing. She says the investigation only involves monetary payouts. Some were significant, often sustained, and seemed to have been approved by senior executives at the paper. The evidence investigated by police was actually handed over by an internal inquiry set up by News Corp, in part to show American authorities it's taking allegations of bribery seriously to head off any prosecution or investigation under the U.S. Foreign Corrupt Practices Act. Mike Kaler is a professor of business law at Butler University who specializes in that federal law.
The notion that FCPA enforcement actions only involve the suitcase full of cash to government leaders to get government contracts, that ship has already left the harbor.
Kaler says Akers' testimony ratchets up pressure on News Corp. In a statement, Rupert Murdoch once more vowed to get to the bottom of earlier wrongdoing, and he added, quote, "The practices Sue Akers described at the Leveson inquiry are ones of the past and no longer exist at the Sun. We have already emerged a stronger company." David Folkenflik, NPR News.
And now to a new technology that could help alleviate another problem for automobiles, gridlock. Car makers are working to come up with some high-tech solutions to traffic jams. As NPR's Annie Baxter reports, computerized cars could help reduce congestion on the roads.
Just how chaotic will traffic be once 4 billion vehicles are clogging the world's roads by mid-century? The executive chairman of Ford Motor Company doesn't want to know the answer.
To me, that's a very unappealing prospect.
Bill Ford Jr. delivered the keynote address at a big technology summit in Barcelona yesterday. And he talked about the need for automakers to take on the causes of global gridlock and traffic accidents. He said the stakes for doing so are high. People lose time and money sitting in traffic, and worse.
If you can't move people, healthcare, and food around, you know, you've got a real issue.
One of Ford's solutions involves getting cars to talk to each other and drive more closely together. That would alleviate congestion. Bryant Walker-Smith is an expert on internet and automotive research at Stanford University. He says just about every automaker is looking into the kind of vehicle automation that could reduce traffic and accidents. Even Google's a player on this front with its concept for driverless cars. But Smith says some of these fancy new automation systems could have unintended consequences.
For example, a driver may feel more confident in checking the cell phone or even checking an email, believing that the system will catch their errors or alert them to issues.
So as these technologies solve some problems, they may yet create others. Annie Baxter, NPR News.